during the hearing. Thank you. Yes,
going next to page 20, this is rule 44.5.9, and this is the covenant area. The reference to a wedding chapel. Now, my understanding is that the Environment Court limited the number of wedding events. Are you familiar with these specific conditions? Because I clearly recall a reference to 12 days and 6 events. So my question to you, first of all, if you're familiar with the conditions, does this create an opportunity for unlimited events?
This is intended to be the target, if you like, from the coming detention area, so it's not designed to be an open entrance. It's just a not covenant in that particular activity. My understanding is that the wedding chapel has been established through consent in terms of these. This is Bob and Tammy's property, but not.
So, what are you talking about too? Is it the
function, there's the wedding event and function event, which is not actually the event, I'm not
sure. The water.
Which is on the ocean. And that, yeah. And across the road at Bronham Craig's house, they've got a consent for an allocation for the Red Chapel. Not the things, but the actual services.
So when you say they've got consent for the chapel, what does that allow by way of activity?
That was the actual running of the wedding ceremonies, if you like, on that site. And that comes back a few years now. So they acted, if you like, on covenant by getting the agency for the chapel. And so far as I'm aware, are still doing that. And I haven't had a look back again at consent, and it's done somewhere around 2010 when I got the consent. I might have changed since then.
I'd like some clarification. I don't really know if David Galloway can provide that, or whether it's part of your and the court decision condition, and how those activities are now incorporated into the zone, whether that's picked up as one of the methods to kind of
yeah,
but
sure. Yeah, the table will certainly.
Going next to page 25, see. These provisions relating to closing public access. See, refers to closing the trail along the station foreshore as the landowner considers necessary for a golf operation. Then the next one, D, the landowner has discretion relating to the access trail in the open space and farm areas for such periods as it deems necessary, and to another provision for restricting access through an area being used for sheep farming. Now, why is the open-ended, I think the Environment Court decision was very specific about the period of time that the trail would be closed. In relation to farming, it did make reference to land. Are you able to clarify how this was intended to work, and if you would see a problem with unfettered discretion?
I think it just needs to be some recognition perhaps of, forgetting that, I mean, I think it could be the table will closely attend this point.
Okay.
But, and I think I could probably leave there because I think we need to carefully look about what the conditions were at the time of the consumer providing for them, and what that comes if there is any difference, why that might be necessary. I might need to come back to that on the table. I'll make a note of it first.
Thank you. Going on to 44.6.8. These are rules relating to site coverage and building areas, and yesterday we clarified how these are numbered relating to growth floor area thresholds for arrival. So within the nature activity area, 3,500 square metres of growth floor area seems to be quite a lot. And what activities are anticipated within that? I made a note that it was both visitor accommodation and the golf cutout. And it possibly refers to 44.5.10. Is anything else anticipated besides those two activities?
Yeah, but that's the main one, is the visitor information. There's 12 level visitor information units that were run up and made the double story.
Got any idea how large they are?
There was the golf course clubhouse itself, restaurant, cafe, and the associated sales and offices areas. And those are the primary activities. And my understanding from the other part of the design center is that that represented the cumulative area of the buildings that were quite important.
So within the golf facilities overlay, there's a maximum total footprint of 700 square metres for maintenance buildings and such like. So that's where your 3,500 square metres has come from. Do you recall what size the residential accommodation units are? You said that they're 2 stories.
Yeah.
That's probably on the table in one of the things.
Yeah, well, I can maybe push that out and on the table about the area of the gross floor areas. My understanding was that the gross floor areas were computed from the frame of the program that's going to be referring to the gross floor building. And I can just see that. We've got a drawing I can show you of the developed design of what was approved by the court.
It's attached to one of Because there's limit protection of the person who lives in the sheep.
Yeah, that's
so right. 13A over there.
That's the thank you for that. Okay. Thank you very much.
Oh, that's quite funny.
What was that?
All right. Thank you very much.
Which one is it? Number one. Clubhouse.
Well, no, the buildings themselves is number one, I think, is the clubhouse, isn't it? But these are accommodation residences as well.
Shearers, quarries,
covered car park buildings.
Woohoo. Thank you.
The table. On page 34, relating to engineering housework, do you know if it was just clarified whether the dating point had come from the consented drawing, or had they been amended?
They are from the consented drawings. There have been obviously eight which are not, and three which have been updated and now were incorporated into these names, so they don't change, but are different from the court's figures. And they were three home sites where the landowner has received reasonable consent to modify those home sites. And I can give you the consent reference of that.
No, that's not necessary. There are three. I understand whether they, what we were looking at was.
Can you identify which three?
No, not quickly. I can, but. It would take me.
That's right.
But to get the two.
Just see if there's an email.
There is an email.
And this blue, does it explain how those points were arrived at 48 plus yesterday?
Yes.
I'm pleased to know most of the other questions I had have already been asked. Yeah. That the final question is on page 38 where the provision for non-notification applications is set out. There are a number of matters that have been deleted, so can you just take us through the reasoning behind the non-notification provision with controlled activities?
The principle, if you like, behind the requirement in close screening was around the potential for any one of those sites, any one of those activities, to result in effects that might be externalised beyond the boundary of that site in a way that either a neighbour, a person, or the public generally might
so in relation to the measures that have now been deleted, how would they be considered? Some of them are residential units, and some buildings. I can't recall now what activity status they have or supposed to have, but. Why have they been deleted?
Well, I think the farm buildings is one that's controlled as to the scale and the height. So these two farm buildings wouldn't comply with the standards relating to the scale and the height of the location of the building. And just recognising that we may be a scale of farm building which is produced, which is quite adverse in terms of its landscape effects. And It's simply providing the possibility for council to make a determination on notification. It's not saying that it will be notified, it's just saying that's within the realms of council's normal course of judgments and decision.
All right, so what I understand you to be saying is that if not specifically referenced here, then the standard chief and section 95 would apply.
Correct.
Thank you. And is there some sort of reference in the plan as a whole to the notification or otherwise? We are not specifically referenced to the individual person.
Not that I'm aware of.
Well, it's a default position anyway.
That's right, I mean, it's just comes back to the
act.
Yeah. I don't think there's a standard, I think it's just a part of the act.
Sure, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. That was the last question. Thanks very much for your help.
You'll be delighted to know that planning is not my area of expertise, so I didn't hover too much on the policies, the rules, and you'll be aware of the phrase that what's the definition of an elephant is a mouse designed by committee. And it would attempt, we've been through an exercise yesterday and today where we've looked at a framework that's been put in place, I sent to the press, that has, it's attempting to define the zone, and it's the same issue with most zones that it's a recurring theme. Dr. Reed considered that the degree of liberalisation of future development which the proposed zone would provide for is far and beyond the ability of the landscape to absorb. But that's not close. That's far and beyond. That's a reasonably strong statement, we think. In terms of what we've just tried to exercise and go through, would you agree with that statement? And is that something, obviously that's a, but how do you, in the context of what we've just tried to do, how does that statement still, does it still have effect?
Yeah, well, obviously the answer is that much was
denied.
Yeah. But I'd be interested to know if you would ask the question of Dr. Reed, what built up that opinion, if you know what I mean. So unpacking that to find out what was the components of that. Okay. The reason I say that it was a threat that went through the council's reports and the landscape report relating to the framework and how it's managing open space and the open space farm activity area, which it appeared to me heavily weighing on the council's mind around the management, the framework for the management of activities and their effects within the open space, for example. And it may well be that it was more of a fundamental question about the actual activity area classification itself. And that was the conversation that, these are the conversations that I had with Mr. Baha around the reduction of the area of OSF and reversing that more into the rural general.
Yep.
I don't know whether that was, that obviously probably haven't had an opportunity to consider that.
That was leading on to my next question. Given what we've been through in the last day and a half, do you think that would, those concerns would still apply? I mean, obviously that's from a planning perspective as opposed to a...
there's an approach which I've outlined which has attempted to address that directly, and I hope, but I don't know, if that satisfies circumstances. But it's certainly attempting to resolve it and come much closer in a way that I felt was appropriate given my concern, if you like, about having a complete detachment between the areas around the zone with the open space protection and the revege areas being completely detached from the zone. What I set out, if you like, is an alternative approach which doesn't exactly provide what not to read the same, but it comes a lot closer.
Can we get closer still?
Well, I think no, because that's the point at which we start to compromise the link between the enablement of the development and the protection measures and the positive benefits. And that's quite important to me, that there are those strong links within the provisions of the legislation zone.
One last question. I apologise if you have already answered it, but I haven't read back over my notes. I floated the suggestion that this entire zone might be a sub-zone in the rural zone. I think, from recollection, you said you think about it. Have you thought about it, and do you have an answer for me?
Yes and yes.
And what's the answer?
Brilliant.
I think the answer is that yes, it could be done.
Any final thoughts? Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Ferguson, for your contribution sort of above and beyond the call of duty. Just thank you, Galloway. Given the colours of the master to when we're going to get Mr. Ferguson's table, I thought I'd better ask you so you can volunteer services for the master.
I think it is a large and important piece of work, so that deadline we talked about on Friday is I'd say the realistic one by the time first draft gets done and gets checked and so on.
So 5 p.m. next Wednesday.
Wednesday.
And that is your reported deadline. Can I emphasise, given Mr. Page's representations, the table is not another version of planning conditions. This is purely a reference. Reference information.
Yeah. And by noon Monday, instructor will get that indicative plan in confirmation and writing of the additional revegetation.
Thank you very much. And, thank you for thank you very much to the team who have departed, and Mr. Graves, the last representative of the audience. Thank you for
your
work.
Well, thank you for your
results
last night as well.
Good
luck with the
Walker Tiku
session.
Yeah.
Thank you. Submissions in full. You don't need to read to us any quotes, but to start at the beginning, go on to the end, and
then stop.
Okay. I'm doing the test with that. Okay, well, I will clarify that you can have submitted Clinic Heights Limited, the 531. And you'll see there at paragraph 2 the subject area which is being discussed in their submission, and quite clear visual representation of the farm in question is submitted in this EVP as well, and included in the summary which you will get to after that. So provided in my overview, the submission set up following it being an overview of the parts of the submission which are being actively pursued, so a bit of clarification on the extent of relief being pursued in this hearing. A consideration of the remaining areas of disagreement, which, as I'll take you through, you'll see have been quite considerably confined in terms of the landscape that is outstanding. Then a review of the approaches which are discussed by the respective landscape experts to come to those conclusions. And finally, a short discussion of the council's above evidence. So, by way of overview, and summarising the evidence in chief, Mr. White, the scope of what's being actively pursued by the submitter has been much confined from the original submission. The issues being pursued in this hearing were now very narrow, relating to only the O&L and RLC boundaries over the site and its surrounds. To clarify, those remaining parts of the submission not addressed within the evidence presented by the submitter and in the submission are not being formally withdrawn from the submission, however they are not being formally pursued in this hearing.
Number two, can I test that out? One of the points being raised about the O&L line at the lakeside end. The SMA
of the site.
And the SNA, which is on the site, I contend with the O&L line, so I put that to one side. But the SNA, the logic of Dr. Reed and Ms. Melkoff was that, and unlike Ms. Stephen, they felt that the O&L line wasn't the appropriate mechanism to protect the SNA or the SNA stood in the context of the ecological permissions. That I'm interested in the logic, your logic, the rationale as to why, if you're not pursuing it at this point, you're not withdrawing that aspect of the submission. You put it in concrete terms, I'm interested in whether the rationale is that if you are successful on the L&L line, to push it further than nearer to the river than Ms. Melsop and Dr. Reed, the next angle will be an environmental challenge to the SNA, having locked down the O&L line. That's an unduly cynical, I know, but it's a Friday morning walk. Probably put the cards on the table. So explain to me the rationale, your client's rationale, for maintaining that aspect of the submission on the SNA. Because I've told you my cynical assessment as to what I thought might be behind it, so I'm inviting you to give a less cynical and more reasoned rationale for your position, your client's position.
Yes, absolutely. The submitter has elected to run a fine case in this hearing and has elected to do that by engaging landscape expert evidence to challenge the findings of the ONL identification over the southeastern corner of the site. Now, I'm not sure if where you're referring to that you can identify appears from how I look at the respective landscape architect plan to be situated within RLC categorisation, both from the Melsoff plan as well as from the SES plan. So I'm not sure that the ONL that we're challenging at this hearing is actually that relevant as overlaid with the SNA identifier.
Well, perhaps it's not, but as I say, explain to me if you're not pursuing the SNA, what the rationale for maintaining the submission is.
Well, I mean, I can't talk to that area sort of possible circumstances that might happen in the future, but at this stage, you know, my client has elected not to actively pursue that based on ecological reasons. So, you know, you don't know what sort of future changes might happen to the PRD, which might change the position in that respect, but at this stage, the submitter has instructed that they are not going to challenge that in the hearing.
Please, Karen.
So turning to the remaining areas of the landscape classification agreement, and we've just sort of narrowed down that we're talking about the southeastern corner of the site. The matter of the landscape classification boundaries is now largely confined as a result of the two landscape experts' opinions regarding a revised boundary classification from the notified position in the PDP. The revised position between the two experts is summarised in the evidence of the SEC. As the Chair's requested, I won't go into reading out the SEC's pre-lodged evidence, and he can talk you through that in his summary as well.
I should say we also have the benefit of an extended discussion with Mr. Espy in his capacity as the witness for Mr. Cooper. As regards the terraces on the opposite side of the Hawea River, and I pose the question as to whether there was a symmetry in his approach. I think he might have confirmed that. But in a sense, this is the other side of the same coin, by his logic. So.
I think
we understand the answer.
The commission will be well versed in these considerations then. So I'll carry on at my paragraph 8, following on from this MFRDC summary, is that both of this agreement, as we said, is at the southeast corner of the site, being the lower terrace area immediately in the vicinity of the Fruta Hawea confluent and west of that Hawea 6. I refer to these submissions here as the terrace confluent. Mr. Espy's tendencies here show the difference remaining between the respective opinions as to the landscape classification over the split conflict. I'll try and skim over this briefly then as well, because I assume that the Commission has the opportunity to question Ms. Melsoff on her findings in this area as well. So please feel that in if I'm that the Commission didn't wish to go over. But Ms. Melsoff's evidence provides a summary of the methodology employed in the landscape boundary identification. I worked through that methodology, so excited. But she briefly talks, as I state in micro 11, about the most pertinent landscape characteristics and values requiring protection in the upper Fruta area, being natural characters of the upper landscape, lakes and rivers and their margins, which would be those that are ONX or ONL. The legibility, openness and pastoral or indigenous vegetative character of the upper Fruta basin, outreach plains, moraines, river terraces, outreach bank and fluvial escarpment. There's no thought analysis for landscape boundaries over the site, and her evidence do not appear to make reference to the landscape related objectives and policies of the PDP. And appears to rely predominantly on alternative processes of fluvial action, coming to her conclusion that the lower terraces of the crossroad farm property and on any side of that harvester are part of the legible proof of how they're confluent fluvial landscape and have been included in this OL. This analysis of my submission does not appear to refer back to other particular characteristics and values to be protected in the aquifer, including openness, pastoral and indigenous vegetative character of fluvial escarpment and natural character of margins. Conversely, I submit that the evidence from Mr. Effie sets out particular characteristics and important qualities of both the Lake Bronx landscape and the relevant parts of the Fraser River ONX in his paragraphs 17 and 18. These values are then used to inform the analysis of how far, if at all, protrusion of the Fraser River ONX should extend into the adjacent landscape. In distinguishing between the Fraser River ONX and the adjacent terrace confluence, Mr. SSB's resulting boundary is one which more closely follows the escarpment of the river corridor itself, thereby distinguishing its features from the adjacent modified and pastoral landscape. Mr. SSB's concluding points pertain not only to fluvial formation of the landscape, but also rely upon the distinctness or usability of the terrace confluence from the other RLC lands in the north, the distinct bounds of the river feature itself, and human modifications of the terrace confluence. I suggest that the approach...
I wonder whether 15 might be more correct to talk about Mr. Espy relying on the lack of distinctness or the legibility. Because as I understand his reasoning, he's saying that there was a distinct line at the top of the first river terrace and no distinct line above that.
Mm.
So when I say
the distinct bounds of the river itself.
I mean the previous sentence. Yeah, it relies on the distinctiveness and legibility of the terrace confluence from other RLC land to the north. Whereas I understood that Mr. Espy was making the opposite point, that they're not distinct from the other RLC land to the north.
Yes, sorry, I think that sentence could be more accurately read as you say, relying on the legibility of the ONF of the Clutha Hawea River confluence and its distinctness from the terraces. You're correct. Thank you, Chair. If I may carry on, I submit that the approach from Mr. Petty in clearly setting out the respective characteristics and values associated with each part of a landscape or feature is quite helpful. This is particularly evident in more recent case law where determinations of appropriateness are made with respect to the values of the objects being protected.
Now, Ms. Hill, that I presume is a cross-reference to Cleverly, which you go on to discuss. The question I have for you is that, as you put it, that wasn't what the Supreme Court of King Salmon said, was it? They talked about the object to be protected, which was, in Section 6B terms, the outstanding natural landscape, rather than the values thereof. So I think that...
So, are you saying that your understanding of the commentary of the majority decision in the Supreme Court was that the qualifier of inappropriateness is determined by the object which was to be protected rather than the values of the object which
was to be protected? That was how I read it, and if you can refer me to something that talks about the values in the Supreme Court, then I'll be grateful for a reference because that was, as we've all only read 1747 times, the different paragraphs tend to blur into each other in memory.
I agree. I don't have a reference to hand, but I can consider that further. But as I go on to cite in Kalbili and admittedly being on the environment court decision, I think the commentary from that, which is most helpful, is the consideration of particularising and a plan for characteristics of an ONL to protect it, which is helpful for future decision makers to then assess if there is a qualifier of inappropriateness in the plan, that measure against those values both that you arrive. So I think what I'm trying to say here is that Mr. Estes' analysis is quite helpful in the way that it clearly sets out the characteristics of the Clutha River Olenek and his landscape degradation.
And you could equally say that Ms. Mousehold, by fingering the legibility of those terraces as the key element that she identified as indicating distinctiveness, has done the same. So that is the relevant value from her point of view, the face of the RML. Mr. Hawksby obviously takes a different view, but if you're talking about characteristics, she accepts that. Although perhaps less obviously than on the Cooper land, but this land is heavily modified. And she says, well, Parkins Bay says that landforms might prevail, might be determinative of an ONL status, notwithstanding the degree of development, pastoral intensification, whatever sort of development it might occur. So do we get back to, it's all which values are determinative in the minds of the respective landscape architects?
Well, yes, of course, I think that's what it does come down to, is that ultimately the determination of where a line will go will be based upon a preference of reading to landscape architects together, and that will ultimately be, you know, a question of finding a preference in both of those respective pieces of evidence.
Thank you.
So I don't think I need to go on to my citations of Cal, really having discussed the core aspects of that. And I guess we've just touched on that next comment.
Well, I suppose the quick question, when I read your submissions, I went back and refreshed my memory as to what Judge Hassan's court had said about that. It seemed to me that the paragraph you've quoted was not a general statement, but was in the context of a plan that directed that kind of assessment based on the particular values.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a different view that that Judge Hassan's court wasn't setting a general principle, but was interpreting the plan?
I agree, but I also understood that the judge's commentary was commending their approach in the plan as well, which had those quite detailed working sheets supplementing the plan, which detailed, as I said, you know, the characteristics of each ONL and each ONS in that district. And I understood the commentary to be, as I say, you know, saying that their approach in that incident was quite helpful.
Yeah, I think I understand what you mean. I think I wouldn't disagree that that's a fair interpretation of the judge's reason.
And I guess in respect of my paragraph 20, we've also touched on that now in our conversation, that this is essentially a fact-finding exercise. And I appreciate that despite where landscape boundaries begin and end is a complicated matter, and one which maybe isn't hard line on the plan with. So it presents all the nuanced considerations that go into making those, I guess. In respect of the council's planning evidence and rebuttal, by way of clarification, I just note here an excerpt from the Tabar section 42A report, which refers to and relies on Ms. Mousehold's findings. And I think what's being discussed in that paragraph here is relating to the Dublin Bay Melton Bridge channel and the outwash terraces on the eastern part of the Crossall Farm site, which, as you'll see from Ms. Mousehold's evidence and SB's evidence, has been agreed between those experts. The an RLC credit organisation rather than OL.
In summary, Mr. Barr hasn't caught up with the fact that that is going to be a bit shifted from the notified position.
Either that or perhaps it was even just a typo which missed out the words I do not consider.
Brilliant. But I think we all know the council's position is approved. We know your point.
Good. Okay. So I go on to extract a paragraph from the Smellsbox rebuttal evidence, which contends that Mr. Estes' conclusions were somewhat contradictory, and including the lower Hawea River and an OL, while maintaining that the river is not an OE and the confluence area is not an OL. So I can wonder if some of that perceived contradiction may have come from the mislabeling of ONF and ONL on the CC even in chief lots, which, as we'll see in the summary, has been corrected, and I'll defer to Mr. CC to talk you through his categorisation of an ONF as opposed to an ONL in this respect as well. It's admitted that there is no contradiction here, that Mr. EC clearly explains the protrusion of the Clutha River ONF into the Hawea River Corridor is justified on the basis that the river corridor itself is generally part of the river feature itself, distinct from the surrounding landscape, distinct from surrounding landscape, but also particularly natural in terms of vegetation. Floods may not ownership and therefore not be modified by many decades of farming use, and is dramatic in terms of its aesthetic. Conversely, Ms. Melfort's justification for characterising the Clutha River ONF as part of the broader landscape confluence on ONL is somewhat confusing. In the evidence in respect of the submission 400, she states that as the PDP objectives for Queen rules are identical for ONL and ONF, I do not consider it as necessary to define a boundary between the ONF of the Clutha River and the Hawea Rivers and the wider ONL. She then goes on to state in her rebuttal evidence, referring to Mr. Keith's evidence, that the Clutha River corridor ONL is not sufficiently large to be a landscape in its own right. He refers to an environmental decision that provides guidance on how large an area of land must be before it can be considered a landscape rather than a unit of a wider landscape. And she goes on to address the Wesley decision in question, noting that though principles of spouse in that decision are not intended to be applied as a rule, but rather an aid to assessment, and that the Clutha River corridor and the Clutha Hawea River confluence landscape find in Merton is over 1,600 hectares in size and well above the minimum 600 hectares suggested in that court's guidance. I then go on to state that Ms. Melfort's characterisation, however, does not assess the other indicative dimensions provided by the court, which included a minimum distance of 1.5 cash price. And I appreciate that in the summary he has noted that in some areas of that landscape it narrows to 1.1 k in some areas. And I don't disagree with Ms. Melfort's reading of that court decision that it is intended to be guidance only.
And it's also intended to be for flat landscapes, where this has got a large in size river or whatever. So that might suggest that, I think, I might be interested to see if Lynn Nelson gave the evidence about Joe Jackson saying that in his suggestions were tentative. But I think it's probably a general way of better response is that they were directed at a different type of landscape to the one they're looking at here.
Well, yes, both of those might well be distinguishing factors in that case, these facts on the ground. And as I say, I think those are guiding principles, which are of some assistance. But as I go on to say in the next paragraph of my submission, I think what's also relevant is the distinction to be made between what are categorised as outstanding features and those which are outstanding natural landscapes. So that is somewhat helpfully referred to in Dr. Reed's initial assessment, where she notes the Oxford Dictionary definition of a feature and the distinctive characteristic part of the thing, and that she considers that Pluka River Corridor is a distinctive part of the glacial and fluvial landscape of the Upper Perth Basin, and continue to consider it correctly identified as an outstanding natural feature. And Mr. Eby also refers to their commentary and summary, which we'll take you through in a moment as well. And I also think that the conflation between ONS and ONL is also inconsistent with Dr. Reed's evidence in respect of the landscape chapter presented earlier on in the district plan review hearing before a differently constituted steering panel, where she noted that ONS is distinguished from ONL under the operative plan. The more stringent rules which apply to ONL or to the basin apply to features, no matter where they are located in the district. And then she goes on to say, landscape feature is a distinctive or characteristic part of the broader landscape, something which has high value but which is not a landscape in its own right. And so I acknowledge there at paragraph 30 of my submission that the distinguishing approach between rules for ONS and ONL no longer remains in the PDP as it formerly did in the ODT. However, it is clear that there is common understanding that a feature is something different from a landscape, having its own defining characteristics requiring protection. I submit that Ms. Melthorpe's classification does not appear to be based on these first principles, but rather a pragmatic approach following the PDP structure of objectives and policies.
Can I just test that? Because as I understand it, every landscape, particularly outstanding natural landscapes, will have one, perhaps multiple features, which, if they're representative of an outstanding landscape as a whole, are probably also outstanding. And my reading of planning maps is that there is no consistency as to whether ONFs are only defined where they're not within ONLs. I think of Roy's Peninsula, which is defined as a separate ONF, embedded within the entire ONF that starts at the margins of Wanaka.
Or Mount Alfred?
And
within the
ONL? Yeah, and so clearly it's a subset. And
something different.
So, well, it's part of, not necessarily something different, because as I say, the landscape is made up of an amalgamation of features.
I wonder if perhaps when we talk about features of a landscape, one can use small s and capital S, and the latter being an ONF, which refers to Section 50 of the Act. My understanding of Mr. Eastby's evidence and Dr. Reed's analysis is that an ONF capital S, as in Section 50, is something different and in its own right requires protection, and may well exist within an ONL or a wider landscape, but may also exist somewhere else. So I do see that the distinctions are quite different, although they may be held to the same standard within the Act and within the PDP objectives. But I think Mr. Eastby might be able to shed some more light on the difference as well.
Clearly it mattered under the ODP there were different rules for outside the Wolf River Basin. There were different rules for ONS than for ONLs. But with the effective amalgamation, well not amalgamation, but with the PDP applying effectively the same policy approach to both, is it now a matter of academic interest where the boundary of of an O&L if it's embedded within an O&L. I say academic of no practical interest, but I suppose where I'm getting to is I wonder whether it's just a massive red herring that Mr. Espy's argument is effectively, and I don't wish to use the word argument in a pejorative sense, his reasoning doesn't turn on whether it's a landscape or a feature. And maybe a Freudian slip of having labelled the Hawea Valley at OML just tends to emphasise that the it doesn't get at the essential issue, which is whether it's a feature or a landscape, where's the boundary? Where does it cease to be outstanding? So, like I'm, that's not really a question. We're really putting an idea there because I'm going in literally slow circles, having heard these arguments before, trying to get a better understanding of the points of difference. So, as a you can comment on that as you wish.
I'm not sure. Yeah. Okay,
shrink
the one question for a bit.
Fair comment. My colleagues will give me a hard time about that in due course.
Are you still in the running for the most complex question
out? I think I'm the clear leader. You'd have to say, is clearly in the statement. I'm giving him a bit of a nudge there, producing a statement without a question.
Yeah. But I guess if I may, I'll just make one comment, which was near the start, that
ramble
was that is this all academic? Well, and you know, and if only and O&Ls are held to the same standard under the PDP now, as opposed to the opposite approach. Well, I guess I might just refer back to, you know, the first principles which we've talked about and which are referred to in the Man of War case cited in the Court of Appeal, that, you know, the first step in this process is to define landscape and features according to the landscape evidence or best practice, or say if we had a higher order planning documents in the chain of RNA documents which have a form guidance on that, and from there you apply your planning mechanisms to provide the requisite section 6 section. So I just want to emphasise that my citations of Ms. Melsop's findings just pose the question that the analysis of the landscape lines on the ground approach it from that way around, rather than picking up the PDP objectives and policies which might conflate the two features and landscapes together, and then, you know, saying it doesn't really matter how they categorise on the ground.
Yes, the other thing that I wrote by margin in response to that point is having criticised Ms. Melsop, gently criticised, I understand, for not having regard to the objectives and policies, are you doing the converse now, criticising her for having regard to them in a different context?
No, I don't think so, because I think that the criteria in her evidence at the beginning establishes that one of the factors in arriving at landscape decisions is to regard those objectives in the PDP. But I think, and what I take from that methodology is the intent that when you define the landscape categorisation on the ground, then you consider how that fits into the objectives framework, rather than the other way around.
And
And certainly no Walker's support to that proposition. But Walker's support tells you that that is the only way to do it. Another aspect that you can comment on, or Mr. Aspect, this week in advice with technical guidance. I think that your submission is based on matter of war, that definition of an RL is in fact a three-stage process. First defining a landscape, then decided natural, then decided it's outstanding, and the same features. Is that what you're suggesting?
I think I'd prefer to defer the rest of Mr. Easley in respect of how he's made that improvisation.
A wise move. I'll be interested in Mr. Easley's opinion. Please carry on.
So if I may just take you briefly to my conclusion then, which is where we ended, is that I consider Mr. Easley's fine-grained analysis of the site and its surrounds has been very helpful and supportive over the approach from the Nullarbor, which relies mostly on a tree of confluence as deriving its characteristics from the visual formation of the trees and how they're rooted. I submit that Mr. Easley's careful and detailed assessment of the characteristics and values of both the Bonnet landscape and the Kluver and how they are river confluence only are most helpful, and that this will assist future planning interventions as the value sets are sequentially considering appropriate attributes.
Thank you.
Thank you, if I may, I will introduce the landscape evidence from Mr. Easley. So summary has been pre-circulated. Do you wish to send your hand out to the copy?
No, we haven't.
Okay.
Thank you. I wonder if, a good question I just come through with my colleagues. Well, it's a pleasure to see Mr. White once again. I don't have any questions for him. I think the commissioner has just elbowed me ever so politely to say that she doesn't need him. And so while, as I say, it's a pleasure seeing Mr. White, if you you could exit the stage right if you wish.
No, I don't have anything to say. So you can wait. Put up with morning.
Thank you, commissioners. I was proposing just to read through my statement.
Please do.
And it might be helpful, once we get into it, to have my primary evidence with you, particularly as appendices, which is of those. So, going to my summary, commissioners. I start paragraph 3. In summary, my opinion regarding landscape categorisation in the relevant vicinity is shown on appendix 4 of my evidence in chief. By way of correction, the eastern two ONL labels on that plane should read ONF, as I consider that the Kluver River corridor is an ONF and not an ONL, as I set out in my evidence in chief. In this regard, I'm in agreement with the PDP and with Dr. Reed's original report. And to take account of that correction, I attach an amended version of my landscape categorisation on appendix 1. So the only difference there, commissioners, is those two ONF labels. Paragraph 5, there is considerable agreement between myself and Ms. Melson regarding landscape categorisation in the vicinity of Cross Hill Farm. An area that consists of lower terraces and escarpment landforms in the south-east corner of the relevant landholder remains in contention. Ms. Melson identifies this area as being part of a Clutha and Harvia confluence landscape that she categorises as an ONL. I disagree and consider that this area is more appropriately categorised as part of the broad surrounding landscape, which, while pleasant and of a rural character, is not particularly natural or outstanding. In my opinion, the Kluta River Corridor is an ONF. In relation to other types of ONFs, a river corridor is, by definition, long and thin in terms of shape. When the Kluta comes to a confluence with some other watercourse, there was always going to have to be a decision made regarding how much of the confluence of delta area should be included within the feature of the Clutha River corridor. I've concluded that the most correct situation is, as I set out in Appendix 1 of the summary, I consider that this protrusion from the Clutha River corridor at the Hawea confluence is genuinely part of the feature of the Clutha River corridor itself, distinct from the surrounding landscape, which is a pleasant rural farming landscape, but not one that's particularly natural or outstanding, is natural in terms of landform, as almost all landscapes are, but is also particularly natural in terms of vegetation, featuring dense and intact native remnant vegetation cover. It is largely in dock ownership and therefore has not been modified by many decades of farming use in relation to the surrounding landscape. It's dramatic in terms of its aesthetics, a curving sinuous section of river running through an incised naturally vegetated gorge. Ms. Melsop suggests that categorising this very lower part of the Hawea River as being part of an ONF, while maintaining that the rest of the Hawea is not an ONF or an OML, is contradictory. I disagree. For the reasons set out above, I consider that it is logical for the Clutha River Corridor ONF to expand in width at confluence areas to take in some of the confluence delta landform. This is what I've done in my claim of Forms Appendix 1. The confluence area that I have identified is distinct from the surrounding farmland and has clear boundaries. My line generally follows the top of legible escarpments on the true left of the Hawea River that enclose this confluence delta area. On the true right, my line follows the top of the closest river escarpment so as to exclude all the significantly modified land from the ONF. I consider that this confluence area is logically part of the Clutha River Corridor ONF. I consider that the area of terrace and escarpment landform that Ms. Melsop identifies as being part of the ONL is not distinct from the farming landscape that surrounds it, which is categorised as a rural landscape category. It is no more natural than the surrounding farmland, since it is modified and managed in exactly the same way. And while aesthetically pleasant, it is not dramatic, sublime or outstanding in the way that genuine ONLs and ONFs are. Unlike Dr. Reed and myself, Ms. Melsop contends that the Clutha River Corridor is an ONL rather than an ONF. She notes that it is very large, over 1,600 hectares, and therefore is a landscape rather than a feature. As I mentioned above, the Clutha River Corridor has clear boundaries and is relatively narrow, as is expected in relation to a river corridor. Even Ms. Melsop's large Clutha River Corridor ONL is often approximately 1.1 kilometres wide. This does not accord with the guidance regarding minimum size of landscapes that was given in the Seminole Environment Court decisions regarding landscape categorisation in the Upper Clutha area. The Clutha River is surrounded by farmland that is not particularly natural or outstanding, and it is certainly not part of the river corridor. Landscape categorisation must be done on a particularly large scale. In my opinion, the vast farmland area of the Upper Clutha Basin floor is a landscape in its own right. A river corridor that cuts through this farmland is, in my opinion, clearly a feature rather than a landscape. I consider that this accords with the Seminole Environment Court decisions regarding landscape categorisation in Mount Clutha, particularly the finding that a feature is a distinctive or characteristic part of a landscape. The Clutha River Corridor fits this definition. For all of the reasons given above and in my evidence in chief, I consider that the correct landscape categorisation is as per Appendix 1 to the sentence.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Yes, Bruce, and this is for the modification to the eastern portion of the submitted site around the landfill radio area and campground. I wondered if you could just explain, you seem to be suggesting that the source of modification, that is the reason for not including that area within an ONE for ONL. But can you just tell me why you think that those activities have changed the naturalness of the feature or the land?
Well, the exercise really, I suppose, here is to decide a boundary line for the outstanding natural feature. And if we look at Ms. Melsoff's line, for example, which is on Phoenix 3 of my primary, Ms. got that there, this lower terrace area that she includes, if that area was unmodified, didn't contain a highway and a campground and a rodeo and a landfill and a gravel pit and houses and decades of farming, if it was very unmodified and covered in kanaka and remnant vegetation as is the case on the other side of the river, then perhaps we would draw that ONF line to include her area. But when we're drawing a line around the boundary of a feature, an outstanding natural feature, we have to come to a decision about where the outstanding natural feature ends. And so I think it's much more logical to draw that line in a way that excludes the heavily modified area from the feature.
Well, what I'm getting at is it heavily modified, as in walking, doing site visits and walking over that land that you're talking about? The rodeo area, for example, was very little evidence. It was my observation, and you can tell me I'm wrong, but didn't seem to be much evidence of modification as such.
Well, the main modifications that are in that area in the rodeo area are formed roads and tracks, and then moving east from there into the campground area. Well, there's two campground areas, but moving into the eastern campground area, again, there's formed roads and tracks and deliberately planted vegetation and also some facilities and buildings and things. And so it's the accumulation of all of those, I guess, that has moved that part of the land away from being natural.
Obviously the floating question to the river is the main question. The given the events in 1989, when we had a fairly major flood event, the one thing that saved Albertown was essentially the Howier Dam, the Howier Lake itself was not terribly full. Had it been, and had they had to release it, I would suggest that the majority of that area on the True River right of the Harvier campground, which you say is modified, would have had water running through it and would have reverted to natural, up to the road, basically would have reverted up to its natural self, and probably on this other side of the road as well, on the lake side. So that the features that are there are not set in stone. In my mind, if they are roads and tracks, but they are more desire lines than formed roads and tracks apart from state highway 6, I'll give you that. My question, which I'm getting to eventually, is, you've drawn it on the next to the river, but the river's a fluid thing, and that could easily just be drawn in a different location. How do you feel about it? Do you understand the point I'm trying to make?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I guess there's a couple of points there. I mean, doing a landscape assessment of this sort to arrive at lines in the landscape, you really have to take account of what's on the ground and what evidence of modification or the patterns and processes that make up the landscape, whether they're natural patterns and processes or human imposed patterns and processes, they are what they are. And really arriving at these decisions is a matter of fact and opinion rather than trying to forecast what might or might not have happened. I think the modifications that are in that headland area around the campgrounds and the rodeo and what have you, had this land been flooded, of course that would have cleaned things out and would have set things back, but I don't think it would have reversed the modification that's there. The remnant vegetation that's on the other side of the river, probably a happy result of maintaining where it's all dockland on the other side. It really hasn't been managed, and so there's a lot of remnant and revegetated vegetation there. But regardless of the reason, it's there. And so that site is more considerably more natural than the campground site. So I guess when I'm doing these assessments, I take account of what activities can happen as permitted activities and how things can change, because of course no landscape is set in stone, they are dynamic, that has to be taken into account. But I don't go as far as forecasting, I suppose, big events that may or may not have happened. You know, and I think part of the danger here is that in a district plan we identify ONLs and ONFs, and in a practice like mine, people come to us with resource management problems and we take them through, you know, and I find a lot of my time explaining the district plan to people and actually justifying it as well. You know, and I justify it because I generally believe in it, you know, and people say, why is this, what does this rule mean, why? And I justify it. And I think the danger of it is if we include areas that aren't, in my opinion, outstanding natural, then the community can lose faith in these provisions. You know, I see it frequently, people looking at a piece of land and just shaking their head in bewilderment. Why is this an open outlook? And then, you know, I'm sure the intent of the legislation when it was originally written, you know, part 6B, you know, matters of national importance, ONLs, ONFs, I'm sure the intent was, you know, Mitre Peak, Milford Sound, Mount Taranaki, not the Arthur's Point campground.
Albert Town. I suppose the following on from that point, isn't that exactly the man of war argument where the court has said, no, that's wrong, it's not what those icon landscapes, not just those icon landscapes of the Southern Alps, the Field Hills, it's the eastern end of Waiheke Island. That's not a national.
Oh, I agree. I mean, the landscape itself doesn't have to be a landscape of national importance, but I guess the point is coming back to drawing these lines on a district plan map, they have to be robust lines that genuinely contain the outstanding natural feature. A legible, outstanding natural feature that the community has faith in as an outstanding natural feature. And I think if we expand those lines too much to include areas that shouldn't be included, then the community can lose faith in that.
If I may just add to that point, Commissioner, in respect of that what I might also just refer to paragraph 86 of that decision. Where the court said, you know, how we've always said set little is to be gained by applying a range of synonyms to what in the end involves a reasonably direct appeal to the judgment of the decision maker. And those synonyms, some of which have been referred to, is the outstanding, as the sublime, preeminent, or conspicuous. Whatever comparator is taken, the ultimate question is whether the landscape is indeed able to be described as outstanding. And the Court of Appeal, you know, went on to say that comparison can be made region-wide, as per para 93. That means that ONLs should be those that are outstanding in terms of the region's natural environment. And I think that's what Mr. S.C. is coming back to, is saying it's something which is truly outstanding in the normal meaning of that word.
Yes, I understood the argument. I was more reacting to the fact that it was precisely what Judge Newhook said. The process wasn't limiting it to icon landscapes.
Well, yes, I agree with that. I'm not saying that. I think we all agree the Clutha River corridor is an RAF. The question is, where do you draw the boundary of it? And I'm just saying, when you're drawing that boundary, you need to think about what is the recognisable distinct RAF. don't blur that edge too much.
Sorry, that's right.
No, it's because it's all about the edge.
Yeah.
Really. Because I would suggest that, and I've had this discussion with you before, cycling through that area, you're actually not looking at the edge of the river, you're looking at the river itself, how it entertains, how it engages with the landscape behind. And that you get no argument about me about the far side and how it's been dark and it's different. It is different. But the point I was trying to make with the flood scenario is that living memory is short, so if you did actually put a caravan down there that got washed away, potentially it wouldn't reappear there for a decade and the river would regenerate.
No, if you smacked it out, it fell
through.
I guess another point there about drawing this line is that even the land that's outside the RNF, nobody's saying it's not pleasant, beautiful, aesthetically pleasing land. It is. It's land that requires management. Nobody's saying that outside the RNF the land should be able to be developed or anything like that. We're simply saying, you know, there are methods in the district plan and provisions in the district plan for managing all landscapes and protecting all the rural landscapes in this district. So I think by leaving areas out of an RNF, you're not condemning them to some sort of destruction. They'll still be protected. But let's just be honest about the RNF is.
That was after a day and a half of planning, it's good to have an emotional answer. Not looking at anyone, no. God, he's still in the room. I was supposed to think that.
It strikes me, there's only a couple of points to make. Paragraph 19, the last sentence. Areas outside the LML cover the rolling and terraced pasture landscape that takes in much across the farm. The question I have is, and I suppose it is based on our site visit and the fact of having had a week of hearing in Hawea, we went up and down that road every morning and every night. It doesn't look below the O&L line that is now soft and dry. It doesn't look particularly rolling. It looks distinctly like a flat terrace. And so I invite you to comment on that and also to tell me, are there in fact any terraces? I know what you mean about rolling country above the O&L line. Are there any terraces above the O&L line?
I guess when I say rolling and terrace landscape that takes in much of Crosshill Farm, I'm describing Crosshill Farm as a whole and saying it's made up of rolling and terrace country. If we look at any of these appendices, really, my appendix to my summary, we can see the terrace and the escarpments included in using LSOC's own land. If we move north-west of that, it's a bit more rolling, but we then come to another terrace. You can see another escarpment of these sort of semicircle shapes that runs roughly parallel to Dudley Bay Road. If we move further on again, we've got the Meltwood Channel that was identified by Ms. Stephen. So yes, I think that if we keep moving away from the Clutha, we'll keep finding them. Doesn't mean they're all part of the Clutha.
And last point, and I asked you this when you appeared for Mr. Cooper, Mr. Cooper. I'll come back to the point I was discussing with Council. Is this indeed the other side of the same coin? That
accept your argument on the Clinton property, it follows we should accept it on this side, and vice versa.
Well, I'll leave that to you, I think, but I've certainly tried to be consistent the whole way along with it.
But in your mind, is it two sides of the same coin?
Yes.
Same argument.
Yes, it is. Yeah. In my mind, I've tried to be consistent right the way along with Twitha, and so it appears to me that if you accept the argument on one side, yes, it would follow the accept on the other side. There's consistency there.
Similarly, if we didn't accept it on one side, it would be inconsistent to accept it on the side.
I suppose that's right.
Thank you very much, Mr. Eastman. Appreciate your input.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And to our friend, Mr. White.
Pass that on.
Thank you very much. And we'll adjourn this hearing until 3 p.m. on Monday the 12th of June. Will that be here or she's here?
Yes.
Here's what it is.